From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a concert and interview with singer and songwriter Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Music critic Karen Schomer describes his voice as a high, mournful sound that seems to have grown out of the earth as stately as a lonesome pine. He has a new album on Elektra Records. Also, when will African Americans make the same commitment to fighting sexism as they've made to fighting racism? Why are African Americans quick to condemn racism but slower to criticize black male violence against women? We'll talk with Pearl Clegg, who raises these questions in her new book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel's cabinet has overwhelmingly approved a plan for Palestinian self-rule in the occupied territories. The plan offered few details, but it called for Palestinian control over local affairs in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank town of Jericho. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said he believes the agreement will be signed during the round of Middle East peace talks that begins in Washington tomorrow. The plan's drawn strong opposition from right-wing Israelis and from some radical Palestinian groups. The agreement was negotiated with the help of PLO leader Yasser Arafat and was supported by the organization's leadership in Tunis. President Clinton said today that he's still open to sending U.S. troops to Bosnia in a peacekeeping role. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton repeated his position that American troops would be available for peacekeeping duty in Bosnia if a settlement there met certain criteria. Bosnian Croats, Muslims, and Serbs are negotiating in Geneva, trying to come up with an agreement that would partition their country. The president said that before he agrees to send U.S. troops, he'd have to be convinced that any peace agreement was fair, acceptable to the Bosnians, and enforceable. And he said he would want to know in advance how long the troops would stay. Clinton was also asked today about the growing U.S. role in Somalia. Yesterday, American soldiers looking for warlord Mohammed Farah Adid botched a raid, detaining U.N. workers by mistake. The president brushed aside questions about the failed raid and defended the overall U.S. mission in Somalia. He said that U.S. troops would try to fulfill their original mission, making sure food and humanitarian relief were distributed. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Thousands of people on the North Carolina coast are fleeing Hurricane Emily. About 100 of them are taking refuge at a Red Cross shelter in Williamston, North Carolina. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
Most of the people at this shelter are tourists who came to the North Carolina Outer Banks to vacation. John Menzak of Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and his family were one day into their week-long vacation when the order came down to evacuate the coast.
We delayed, hoping they would change their mind. Turns out that there was all kind of doubt as to where that hurricane was going. It was coming in, it was going out, it was going north. And until about noon, we weren't quite sure. About noon, the message came, you better leave, it's mandatory.
Red Cross officials expect more than 300 people to seek shelter here before Emily makes landfall. Many of them are expected to arrive at the last minute, just as Emily's first winds begin to blow. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Williamston, North Carolina.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3 points to close at 3,644. This is NPR. There were more flood problems today for Des Moines, Iowa, which got more heavy rains over the weekend. Thunderstorms dumped from 3 to 5 inches of rain on the area yesterday, with as much as 10 inches in spots. The rain hit ground that's already saturated with water and can't absorb any more, causing sewers to back up and closing several major streets. The Des Moines Water Treatment Plant, which was shut down by flooding last month, was once again surrounded by water, but officials say they believe it will be protected by reinforced levees. Lithuania's president announced today that Russia has agreed to withdraw its final 2,500 troops by the end of this month, as originally planned. Last week, Moscow suspended its troop pullout in a dispute over Lithuania's demand for compensation. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
Speaking over national radio today, Lithuanian President Algirdas Brazauskas said that he and Russian President Boris Yeltsin had agreed to resume the troop pullout in a telephone conversation today. The decision settles the crisis that developed just over a week ago when Russia canceled the final pullout because Lithuania was demanding $146 billion in damages caused during the Soviet occupation. The U.S. warned Moscow that it risked losing $700 million in technical assistance if the pullout was not resumed. For the tiny Baltics and the East European countries, the presence of Soviet troops has been a painful irritant. In pushing to send the Russians home on schedule, Lithuania has opted for negotiating the issue of compensation at a later date. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
The U.S. balance of trade tilted more in the favor of foreign countries in the second quarter of the year. The Commerce Department said the merchandise trade deficit grew to its highest level in 5.5 years during the period from April through June. Economists blamed the recession in some of the best markets for American goods, especially Europe and Japan. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Elektra Nonesuch Records launched its American Explorer series, showcasing neglected or underappreciated performers of American roots music, they released an album by singer Jimmy Dale Gilmore. The album brought him some much-deserved attention. Elektra has just released a new album by Gilmore, and he's about to begin a national tour. Gilmore grew up in Lubbock, Texas, and now lives in Austin. Until recently, he was best known for an album he made in the early 70s with several of his friends from Lubbock, including Joe Ely and Butch Hancock. Their group was called the Flatlanders. When the band broke up, Gilmore took a long hiatus from music. On Gilmore's American Explorer series album, he played mostly his own songs. On the new album, Spinning Around the Sun, he pays tribute to some of his favorite songwriters. This is a song Elvis Presley first recorded. After we hear it, Gilmore will talk with us and play some music.
I was the one who taught her to kiss the way that she kisses you now. And you know the way she touches your cheek. Well, I taught her. I was the one who taught her to cry when she wants you under her spell. The sight of her tears drives you out of your mind. I taught her so well. And
this is Jimmy Dale Gilmore from his new album Spinning Around the Sun. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here. I have to talk to you about your voice. You have a really gorgeous voice. I could spot your voice in a second, I think. It's a very kind of individual voice. And I want to find out a little bit about how you developed your sound. I mean, do you think of yourself as having developed it, or was that just the sound that's always come out when you opened your mouth to sing?
It was totally unconscious. One thing about it is that I know that I never ever tried to copy anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm certain that the people that I love so much, that I listened to so much, you know, had an effect on me. But it was like a subliminal effect or something. I know. See, the way I perceive myself is that I'm not really and truly a musician. I'm not one of these people that, like, you know, hears a melody and could repeat it on the keyboard, or, you know, I have a good enough ear to sing on key, you know, and to I can tell if things are out of tune and stuff like that. But I'm not a musician in the sense of having that kind of focus. It's always been more the feeling and the story and the meaning of the words that have, and of course the melody and the sound has to be there to make that happen. But that's the focus for me.
You've been gracious enough to bring your guitar today. Can I ask you to do a song that's it's a gorgeous song, and it's a song that you've done on your new album. And let me ask you to perform it for us in the studio. I'm thinking of the Hank Williams song, I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Sure. This song is in a way kind of the epitome of what it was like when I was a little kid. That struck me so deeply that it, I think, made me this is one of the things that made me want to be a musician.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is winding low, and I'm so lonesome I could cry. The silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky, and as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry. Did you ever see a night so long when time goes crawling by? The moon just went behind a cloud to hide her face and cry. Did you ever see a robin weep when leaves begin to die? That means he's lost the will to live. I'm so lonesome I could cry. Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low, and I'm so lonesome I could cry. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Oh, that's beautiful. I think your voice was created to sing sad ballads like that. Is that the kind of material you find yourself most gravitating toward as a songwriter as well as a singer?
In the songwriting I have particularly, it's kind of funny because I've always had a real split personality in that regard, because a lot of my favorite stuff is, well, really kind of screaming up-tempo blues stuff, you know, and also a lot of kind of silly comedy stuff. So there's some like real contradictions in whatever it is that attracts me.
What do you mean, like silly comedy stuff?
Well, I'll show you the song.
Okay.
I'm going back to where I come from, where the lilac bushes smell so sweet it darn near makes you sick. I used to think my life was humdrum, but I finally learned a lesson that is bound to stick. I used to go down to the station every evening just to watch that morning train come rolling in, and then one day that great temptation got the best of me and led me to a life of sin. I got my hat and $14 and began that life of trouble that's always bound to follow when you're rich and hunting romance. But my hunting days are over, I can tell you that. I met a gal in Kansas City. She winked at me and asked me if I'd like to step around, and I said, yep, that's what I'm here for. So she said she'd show me to the hottest spots in town, but there were things she had to fix up, so she took my $14, but there must have been a mix-up. She's been gone
since Thursday evening, and I've got a hunch I'll never see that gal no more. When I grow up and have a grandson, I'll tell him about my romance and I'll watch his eyes bug out, but chances are he won't believe me, and he'll do the same darn thing when he grows up, no doubt. But he can't say I didn't warn him about the wicked way them city gals will all treat you. Gol darn, I'm going back to where I come from, where the mockingbird is singing in the lilac bush.
That's wonderful. You see, do you perform that a lot?
I used to. I haven't thought of it in a long time. I never have really worked it out with the band or anything.
That's really great.
I used to do it at the Threadgills things, when I did my weekly show at Threadgills down in Austin.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jimmy Dale Gilmore, singer and guitarist who has a new album that's just been released on Elektra Records called Spinning Around the Sun. He's going to play for us some more, and we're going to hear more from the new record. But first, we're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. Guitarist and singer Jimmy Dale Gilmore is my guest, and he's got a new album on Elektra Records called Spinning Around the Sun. You were born in 45, so you kind of came of age at about the time of rock and roll, right?
Uh-huh.
So, but you were growing up in Texas. Did you listen to a lot of country and rock and roll at the same time?
Yeah, both of them. But my dad was a guitar player, a country guitar player, and country music was, and even till this day, is like probably the most sacred thing in our family. You know, I think in a lot of ways music has almost replaced religion with a lot of people.
So your father played guitar?
Yeah, he played guitar, and so we were surrounded by music always, the radio and everything. And then, you know, when I was about the fourth grade, I started seeing Elvis on the Dorsey show and Steve Allen and like that, and I remember that stuff very vividly, and how much he affected me from the very beginning. I remember hearing Little Richard for the first time on the radio. I think it was Good Golly Miss Molly, when he was screaming that out, and I just fell in love with it immediately. But unlike a lot of my friends, I didn't stop liking the country music.
They stopped liking country?
Yeah, a lot of them, when rock and roll came on, they rejected, because I don't know, maybe they associated it with their parents or something, but because of my particular relationship with my dad, I kept my love of country music even as I picked up on this new stuff.
When you were coming of age and listening to the radio and stuff, country music had already taken on a very show busy kind of glamour. Sequins and big stage shows and mm-hmm. Fancy costumes and stuff, which doesn't seem to be So it doesn't seem to me at all to be the kind of performance that you do. You're not a flashy kind of guy or a flashy kind of dresser. Were you not interested in that aspect of either show business or country music?
Well, one accident, I think I might have been, if it hadn't been that the folk thing came along and Bob Dylan, and the sort of rejection of all that phoniness of show business and all that kind of stuff. I think it was more a fluke of the time than because I, in a sense, identified more with the folkies, in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
I think the accidental blend, well, actually, I guess since with me, it was the convergence of country and Western, rock and roll and folk that were all kind of equally in my background, in the recipe of what my music came out to be.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the ethic or something of the folk music thing, because if you look back to the old Grand Ole Opry and all that, it was all showbiz. It was all kind of like hee-haw all the way from the beginning. The string bean, the banjo player, it was all kind of silly medicine shows, sort of. That's part of its charm in a way. that it was like, it was like kind of a poor people's version of vaudeville and show biz.
There's a song of yours I'd like to ask you to sing. I think this is perhaps your best known song. And it's Tonight I Think I'm Going to Go Downtown. And it's a wonderful song. You wrote it, I think, when you were about 20. Can you put us in your frame of mind back when you were 20 and writing this song?
Well, I was, it was around the time of the breakup of my first marriage, you know, and it was when, I mean, I was still confused, is that the right word? Although that wouldn't contrast it to now too much. But I wrote this song. Actually, I wrote the verse of it probably when I was about 20. And it's one of these songs that took, it probably was a year and a half in the writing. And my friend John Reed wrote the music to the kind of bridge part of it. And then I finished the lyrics. It took a long time to write it. But I've always felt like this song, even to this day, really captured a feeling. It evokes a feeling I had that was like a combination of really sad, but still hopeful. It's almost like a trademark of my whole set of emotions or something about the songs I've written.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the song that, in a way, wears the best with me. Some of my other songs, are, you know, I go to a bridge when I don't want to, when I'm tired of them or they don't seem. But this one, I've always loved. I've never gotten tired of singing this song, and it's, I guess it's still most expresso part of me that's still really there. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, I sure am.
Tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna look around for something I couldn't see when this world was more real to me. Yeah, tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. My love is gone away. My love, what can I say? My love would never see that this world's just not real to me. And tonight, I think I'm gonna go downtown. I told my love a thousand times that I can't say what's on my mind, but she would never see that this world's just not real to me. And tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna look around for something I couldn't see when this world was more real to me. Yeah, tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown.
Beautiful. It's a wonderful song. Have you ever thought of yourself as the kind of person who can't really express what's on their mind?
Yeah, pretty much. I think I've, you know, I told you I've studied philosophy a whole lot, and a lot of what I've studied, I had a professor that taught me logic and linguistic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the thing that comes out of it is a real deep sense of the inadequacy of language. One of my favorite current writers is Robert Anton Wilson, and he talks a lot about the hypnosis that we all sort of live under, you know, that I think has a lot to do with language. It has a lot to do with language causing things to appear to be that aren't, you know. And
We know when you're somebody listening to a song like that, you know, it's such a beautiful song and it expresses so much sentiment, and you feel like saying to the lover, well, didn't you understand him? I mean, gosh, he's he's capable of such exquisite sentiment. Were you the kind of person who would actually, like, write a song to somebody and sing it for them, to sing what it is that you couldn't say? Or is that the kind of thing that just happens in the movies?
Well, you know, I think a lot of, particularly back then, I've never been a very prolific songwriter. I've been around some people that are.
Yeah.
But most of the time, especially in those early days, the only time I wrote songs was when I was real sad and usually in the aftermath of some kind of heartbreak or, you know.
Right.
So it's kind of like when I was in the situation or in the mood of I'm more likely now to write a love song, you know, to write a song that's trying to express something to somebody.
Uh-huh.
Although, in a sense, I think maybe all those songs were also, at least on one level, being sort of some attempts at communication.
I should mention, by the way, that Jimmy Dale Gilmour does his song, I Think I'm Gonna Go Downtown, on his previous Elektra Nonesuch record, his first one for them. Which was called After a While, and he also does it on the Flatlanders album, which is reissued on CD. His new album is called Spinning Around the Sun. Jimmy Dale Gilmour, it's just been wonderful to have you play here in the studio for us, especially since I personally have not had the chance to see you perform on stage. It's been a real treat to hear you perform here. I'd really like to close with something from your new album. And I want to play the very last thing on the record, which is called Thinking About You. This is one of your songs, one of the songs you wrote on the album. Would you say something about writing it and what you were thinking when you did?
Well, this is really, it's my newest song. It's the most recent one. So that makes me really happy to have this feeling that I can still come up with something that I'm really proud of.
You worry that you can't anymore?
Sometimes, you know, I go for spells thinking, boy, I'll never write a song again. I don't worry about it a lot, but sometimes it's really gratifying when I do come up with an idea and then it works out. And this song was particularly, I sort of deliberately composed this song out of an idea I had, because it occurred to me at one point how you can be in so many different places physically but still have the same thing or same person or same feeling or whatever on your mind. You know, you can be, that it's one of the paradoxes of, I think, being a human being.
And I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here and for performing for us. I really enjoyed it a lot. And Jimmy Dale Gilmour's new album is called Spinning Around the Sun. It's on Elektra Records. And I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. And this is Jimmy Dale Gilmour's new song.
It was a beautiful morning on a hill where the wind only carried the sound of the mockingbird song. And I was thinking about you. And all the flowers were dancing. One by one they all told me of the time that had been and the time that will be. And I was thinking about you. I walked on down by the river, saw the sails on the ships that were leaving for places I could only dream of. And I was thinking about you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Major funding for...
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Pearl Clegg angered a lot of people when she wrote her piece Mad at Miles. She was angry when Miles Davis, whose music she loves, wrote about hitting his wife and why she deserved it. Clegg wondered, how can men like Miles hit women and still be our heroes? Coming up, we talk with Clegg about why it's so hard to combat sexism in the African-American community. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Hurricane warnings have been posted for most of North Carolina's coastal areas. Hurricane Emily is now less than 300 miles from Cape Hatteras, with winds of up to 85 miles an hour, and appears to be heading toward the Outer Banks. The hurricane is moving west-northwest at nearly 7 miles an hour and is expected to grow stronger. More than 150,000 people are moving out of low-lying areas of the North Carolina coast. Most left yesterday and this morning, clogging the few highways in the narrow islands. Forecasters say the storm could hit by tomorrow afternoon. National forests in the eastern parts of Oregon and Washington states may soon be open to logging again under a new plan announced today by the Forestry Service. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
There's been no logging in these forests east of the Cascade Mountains since last spring. Forest Service officials halted logging in response to threatened lawsuits from environmental groups. Environmentalists were upset, they said, because the Forest Service was allowing ecologically significant old-growth forests to be chopped down. Forest Service officials said today that they're going to put together an ecologically sound plan to manage the forests, but that plan won't be ready until next fall. Now, Forest Service officials say they want logging to begin sooner than that. They say logging towns are hurting and that the forests need to be thinned to be protected against disease and fire. So the Forest Service will allow some cutting while trying to screen out logging in old-growth patches. So far, though, neither environmentalists nor the timber industry seem to be happy with this compromise. This is Philip Davis reporting.
In Washington, Robert Malval has been sworn into office as Haiti's new prime minister. He will help manage the nation's return to democracy after 2 years of military rule. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
New Haitian Prime Minister Malval told a Washington audience today that he would move decisively to put an end to 2 years of human rights abuses by the country's military. Malval was chosen last month by exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to prepare the country for a return to democratic rule. Last week, the Haitian parliament approved Malval, who is viewed as a bridge between Aristide and the military rulers who seized power 2 years ago. Meanwhile, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission charged in a report this weekend that about 1,500 Haitians had been killed and another 300,000 driven into hiding since the September 1991 military coup. The commission also said that there was a new wave of repression by Haiti's army and other paramilitary groups opposed to Aristide's planned return to Haiti on October 30th. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 3 points to close at 3,643.99 on volume of more than 191 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. On the eve of the opening of the Middle Eastern peace talks in Washington, the Israeli cabinet has approved a draft agreement with the PLO that sets the stage for Palestinian self-rule in the West Bank and Gaza. Cabinet approval came after Israeli Prime Minister Rabin said that the time has come to take a chance for peace. 16 members of the Israeli cabinet voted in favor of the plan and 2 abstain. The approval is the first major sign of progress since the start of the peace talks nearly 2 years ago. The plan calls for autonomy to begin in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank town of Jericho within months. However, it could take much longer to work out details of self-rule. The African National Congress has offered a public apology to victims of human rights abuses in ANC military camps that operated in the 1970s and 80s. But the organization said it will not punish those responsible for the abuses or pay compensation to victims. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The decision not to pay victims or punish their abusers contradicted recommendations made last week by a special ANC-appointed commission. The commission documented a range of abuses, including executions and beatings at the ANC exile camps. But ANC Secretary General Cyril Ramaphosa said ANC officials should not be punished until there is equal punishment for human rights abusers in the white minority government.
Partial punishment or partial reparations is unfair to the perpetrators and victims alike.
The ANC called for creation of a truth commission to investigate human rights abuses committed over the past 4.5 decades. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
President Clinton says that he is open to the possibility that the Senate should consider the North American Free Trade Agreement before the House. There is more Democratic opposition to the plan in the House. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sexism isn't a word that gets used much in the black community, even though it describes a form of oppression that affects the majority population of the community, women. Pearl Clegg makes this observation in her new book, Deals with the Devil and Other Reasons to Riot. She says it's time for black men to take personal responsibility for the way they treat black women. Clegg writes for Essence magazine and is a columnist for the Atlanta Tribune. She's playwright in residence at Spelman College. This is a reading from the beginning of her book.
Why I write. Yesterday, as I was writing this, my neighbor, my sister, had to call the police to protect her from her husband, also my neighbor and my brother, who was threatening to douse them both with gasoline and light it in a murder-suicide if she did not stop divorce proceedings and come back to be his wife. Last week, after class, one of my students waited for me to confess softly that her boyfriend had been beating her, and what should she do? A month ago, a young friend who teaches preschool read to me from her journals a harrowing description of the night her former lover shot himself in the head after she escaped from his apartment following months of beating and torture. My friend, the corporate executive, relates a story of leaping from a speeding car and running into some urban woods after her husband placed a gun to her temple while driving with her down a busy suburban street. My friend, the well-respected public servant, comes to work with sunglasses to hide the two black eyes her husband gave her by beating her head against the wall while their children slept in the next room. My sister, writer with the three young children, tells horror stories of being scalded with boiled water and forced to suck the barrel of a gun as if it was her husband's penis. And my memory of my own nightmare as an undergraduate student at Howard University, listening to my boyfriend tell me I'd better not move as he tied my hands and feet and told me if he couldn't have me, nobody could. But that's not all. I also remember the chorus of black male objections to Intisaki Shange's For Colored Girls. I hear the protests over Alice Walker's The Color Purple, and I remember the forums whining about negative images of black men in the Women of Brewster Place. And I wonder where those same black male voices are when black male violence is being condoned and taught and glamorized and ignored. I wonder when we're going to see the same commitment to fighting sexism in the work of our brother writers that we see to fighting racism. I wonder how much good all those poems about beautiful African queens can do in the face of a backhand slap across the mouth and a merciless rape in the bedroom of your own house.
Pearl Clegg, thank you for reading that. You asked the question, when will we see the same commitment to fighting sexism as we see to fighting racism? What do you think are the obstacles to that commitment to fighting sexism?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that as a group of oppressed people, as African Americans, we are so used to focusing on race as the major problem. We're so used to thinking that racism is the thing that we should be talking about all the time. And racism is certainly one of the things that we should be talking about all the time. The problem is that running parallel to the problems that we have because of racism, we have all the problems that affect us because of sexism. And since there isn't that same kind of discussion going on in our community, it's very difficult for us as black women to raise those questions, to say, let's not stop talking about racism, but let's try to increase that dialogue so that it also talks about brutality against women, so that it also talks about abuse of children, and talks about all of those things that we can handle in our own communities, in our own houses, in our own neighborhoods.
You say most black men won't even admit to the existence of sexism.
Right. because we don't have that dialogue. They're used to talking about race, and in discussions of race, black men are the victims, so that the posture that they can adopt is accusatory. They can talk about the wrongs that have been committed against them specifically and against us as a group of African-American people. So they're used to being the victim. They're used to talking from that posture. The problem when you talk about sexism is that they are not the victims. They are the perpetrators. They are the oppressors. So that it's a very different kind of mode, because when you're the one whose group is oppressing someone, you have to learn how to listen. You have to begin to say, well, maybe my behavior does need, first of all, to be reexamined and then to be adjusted if I do not want to be an abusive person, if I do not want to oppress the women in my life.
I want to ask you something about the language in a lot of African-American pop culture. Two words that are often used to describe women, bitch and African queen. Tell me what both of those words mean to you.
Well, clearly people who are calling us bitches have a problem. They are using language that is oppressive, that devalues us, that makes it acceptable to think of us as less than. Some rap music is very guilty of that kind of thing, that the language used to describe women makes it much easier to think it's okay to rape us, to beat us, to treat us in a way that is other than how we should be treated. So that I'm totally opposed to that kind of language. And it really makes me sad to see some young black women now saying, well, I think that bitch is a badge of honor and it means a strong black woman, because what they're reacting to is the overwhelming use of the word in their communities and trying to embrace it so that it becomes something positive, which I don't think it can be. The African queen designation would be lovely if we were really being treated like African queens. The problem is that we are often not being treated that way, so that I have a problem sometimes with the romanticizing of our African past, as if there was no chauvinism, as if there was no problem with men and women trying to get along in Africa, and it's only something that we've run into here, and if we could just get back to what we were like in Africa, everything would be fine, when many African groups of African people are also faced with the same problem, with abuse of women, with lots of different manifestations of sexism that have not been addressed in those cultures either. So that I have a reluctance, I think, to embrace the kind of romantic notion that now we're all going to address black women as African queens, unless that language translates into specific behavior, unless that language translates into protection of women and children, then it just kind of clouds the issue and lets people make a very romantic stand that doesn't translate into their real behavior.
My guest is Pearl Clegg. She's written a new book called Deals with the Devil and Other Reasons to Riot. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Pearl Clegg is my guest. I want to ask you about your best-known piece, Mad at Miles, which is a piece that you wrote after reading Miles Davis's autobiography, in which he described beating Cicely Tyson and even explained why she deserved it. Mm-hmm. And you accused him of being guilty of, quote, self-confessed violent crimes against women, such that we should break his albums, burn his tapes, and scratch up his CDs until he acknowledges and apologizes and agrees to rethink his position on the woman question. And then you ask, you know, why is there this kind of double standard? We wouldn't accept racist behavior on the part of our pop culture heroes. What if Kenny G beat up black men after his concerts? Nobody would accept that. But if a musician beats up his wife or lover, well, no big deal. Can you elaborate on what you see as that double standard?
Well, I think the problem is that we are so used to being alert to problems of race, that we're so used to calling white people to task when they say something that we know is racist, that we have a method almost in place to click in when we have that kind of experience. But what I was trying to do with that essay about Miles Davis was to look at the fact that we are prepared to forgive people who we have designated as heroes, as role models, for all kinds of behavior behavior against women that we would not accept if it was racist behavior. And the reason that I chose Kenny G as the person to use as a contrast is that a lot of black people really enjoy Kenny G's music, so that we can already see that there is a lot of crossover. We can already see that this is someone whose music we play. And then to raise the question, what if he was beating black men? Most black men laugh at the very idea that little Kenny G could be beating up brothers all over the country. But once they understand how absurd that would be, they can usually take that leap and say, you know, I'm sure I wouldn't buy any music by Kenny G if I knew he was beating black men. And once they can at least admit that, they do make political evaluations in terms of the cultural things that they are prepared to endorse. If they're prepared to do it with race, it at least opens up the idea in their minds so that we can begin discussing it in terms of sexism. Oftentimes we tend to feel as African-American women that we're at a disadvantage because not only do we have sexism to deal with, but we also have racism. But in terms of trying to get black men to understand what the problem is, sometimes their experience with race can be invaluable to us because we can use their experience with one kind of oppression to help them understand another kind. When I talk to my brothers about listening to black women, and they often will resist that, and what I say is try to think of the last time you allowed a white male to explain anything to you about race, and they can't think of a time because they would never allow that to happen. So what I try to say is then take the leap with me and understand that in these instances where we're talking about sexism, where we're talking about domestic violence, violence against women and against children, you have to adopt a listening posture in the same way that you expect a progressive white person to listen when you're talking to them honestly about race. You must begin to listen to it and not instantly begin to defend Miles Davis or instantly begin to defend Dr. Dre or the Ghetto Boys or whoever the black males are that are in question by women, to try to listen to what we say and factor it in as criticism offered in goodwill, as criticism offered because we are convinced that black men can do better.
So did you burn your Miles Davis records?
Well, the terrible thing is I wrote that piece as a performance piece, and at the end of the piece I wanted to burn the records and scratch the tapes and all of that, and I love the music so much that I couldn't do it. And I kept clinging to the fact that perhaps Miles Davis would see the light and make some kind of statement and say he was really sorry for this kind of behavior. Unfortunately, he died before he had a chance to do that, so I still have all of my Miles Davis records and CDs and tapes stacked in the corner because I can't listen to them anymore without thinking about the things that he said and wrote about women, but the music is so important to me that I can't throw it away.
Here you are condemning Miles Davis's behavior and even thinking about destroying his records. Well, at the same time, you purchased a copy of Two Live Crew's album with your daughter. Mm-hmm. What was behind buying that album? And their lyrics are incredibly sexist.
Right.
And violent.
Well, my daughter was at the time old enough, I thought, to make her own decisions, and that what I felt my responsibility was as a parent was to talk to her about why she wanted the record, what she thought about the lyrics that they were singing, why she thought so many people in her group liked the music, and to try to talk to her about the choice that she had made. The danger, I think, when you have strong opinions and you also are raising children is that you can say, no, you cannot do this, you cannot do this, you cannot do this. But I'm also aware of the fact that she lives in the world, that she moves around in situations where I'm not there, so that if the only way that I can help her understand what is helpful, constructive behavior and what is not, if all I can do is say, no, you cannot do this because it's my house and I can tell you what to listen to, then it doesn't help her develop an opinion so that when I'm not there, she'll have a more progressive opinion about what she does and what she doesn't do. So that part of the reason that I was willing to do that, the whole reason why I was willing to do it, is because I think that in order to help a child develop an opinion that they will buy into and that can serve them when you're not there, you have to let them make those choices and say, now, we've got this music, I've listened to it, you've listened to it, tell me why you like it. Tell me what it is that is so good about it that makes you forgive what they're saying about women. And then hopefully in that kind of discussion, in looking at that music with a critical eye, the child will develop a point of view where they won't want to buy it anymore.
My guest is Pearl Clegg, author of the new book, Deals with the Devil and Other Reasons to Riot. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on the agreement between Israelis and Palestinians?
Hi, Terry. Linda Gradstein reports from Israel on the plan to establish a degree of autonomy in Jericho and the Gaza Strip. In other news, Hurricane Emily aiming toward North Carolina. A report on preparations, and I'll talk with a fellow on Ocracoke Island. He's been there for quite a while, lives in a building that he put up himself. He's decided not to leave the island for the moment. SUNY Khalid reports on the swearing-in of Haiti's new prime minister, a man appointed by the exiled president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And Tracy Kidder talks with us about his new book. It's called Old Friends. It takes place in a nursing home in Massachusetts.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Pearl Clegg, author of Deals with the Devil and Other Reasons to Riot. Do you think that for a lot of young African Americans today, there's a feeling that to be really black, you have to be very ghetto or you have to be a gangster, and that being middle class or having middle class aspirations or being educated is really a sign of being white, not black?
I don't think so. I hear that sometimes, but I don't. That's really kind of assuming that these children who are making that choice have presented to them all of the options that are presented to middle-class children, and it's not true. The schools that they go to are not teaching them how to read and how to use computers. The housing projects or neighborhoods where they live, where no one is employed, are not giving them a sense of what family is, what a mother can do, what a father can do, what grandparents can do. So it's not that they look at the possibilities of middle-class life, you know, safety and employment and all of those things, and say, no, I think I'd rather be a gangster. There is no option for them. There are no jobs in that community. There are no family units that are doing well in the traditional sense in their immediate experience. So that it's not that they're presented with the option of a middle-class life and reject it. They are learning to cope in the only existence that is presented to them. I haven't found that black people or black students, young or old, reject people who are reading, who are doing things. There usually are not that many people in the environments that we're talking about doing those things. That's not where the status comes from. So that you see, rather than people saying, okay, I'll, you know, do well in high school and go on to college and get a good job, what people say is, nobody in my neighborhood has a job. Nobody's had one. Nobody's going to have one. So what am I going to do to make a living? How am I going to survive? How am I going to feed my family? So that all of that environment, I think, feeds into kids doing things that from the outside you say, why did they make that choice? But from the inside, that's the only choice that there is.
You're a successful woman. You're a writer. You're a teacher at Spelman College. You're a performer. You've got a lot of things going. How close are you to being exposed on a daily basis to the kind of violence and despair that you've been describing?
Oh, I'm not close. I'm in it. I live in an all-black community that is a, you know, basically a working-class, middle-class mixture of people. And, I mean, I sit in my window in my front of my house. I work at home and watch the crack addicts walk back and forth in front of my house all day long. I watch the young men who are breaking into houses all over my neighborhood, running from the police, throwing guns down the gutter in front of my house, the police spread-eagling them in front of my house. You know, all of those things are very real to me because I choose to live in a black community. I think it's critical that those of us who have resources, who understand how to call City Hall and demand that the garbage be picked up, how to call and demand that we have better police response, it's critical that we stay in communities where the problems are very real and present. Because if everybody who has the skills that I have leaves my neighborhood, then no one will know what to do when we need a police officer. No one will know what to do when we need to go down to City Hall and fuss at the mayor. No one will know how to write an indignant letter to the daily paper or write a column for a newspaper talking about what we're doing. So that it's none of this is very removed and intellectual to me because I live in a black community. I see that all the time. I just put 2 days ago new burglar bars on my house because there were a few windows downstairs that were not burglar barred, and my neighbor across the street was robbed and my neighbor next door was robbed within 3 days. So that it's all very present. None of it is kind of an abstract intellectual response to what's happening. I'm concerned about my own neighborhood, about my own neighbors, and by extension, about the rest of my community. And I think that's critical. It's very important to me to be a part of my group. I don't see myself as different from the rest of the black people who live in my neighborhood. And I think that's the danger when those of us who have skills, who have some privilege, begin to say, well, I'm different, I don't need to be around these folks because they're living too hard. You know, then we leave all those folks to the mercy of the predators who are kicking in their back doors and waiting for them to leave for work so they can go clean the house out.
You said that it's one of the reasons why it's hard for black people to discuss issues of sexism is that the language doesn't exist yet. Do you think that the language that does exist, the feminist language, is seen as being more of a white language that doesn't apply to black
absolutely.
Relationships?
I think absolutely. And part of the reason why it's so important for black women to begin to write about these things and to use these words in context is that part of the problem that we have as African-American women going to be involved in the predominantly white American feminist movement is that many white feminists are very progressive on questions of gender, but have not yet confronted their own racism. They have not been around enough women of color to have developed as progressive a set of positions on questions dealing with race as they have about gender, so that it makes it very difficult sometimes to be a woman of color going to a predominantly white feminist meeting because you find yourself having to do missionary work, you know, where you're saying, okay, before we go on to talk about health concerns, we really need to address the question of race that was raised by that last discussion, that last question, which is exhausting. So that I think it's very important for us as African-American women to begin using the language that applies to women across the board, whatever their community or ethnicity. And it's also important for the predominantly white feminist movement to understand how critical it is for them to confront their own racism in the same way that they're prepared to confront issues of gender. It's really not fair to expect the women of color at the meeting to participate and also to teach at the same time. Everyone can read a book. Everyone can ask for information so that it's not such a weight on us when we go to talk about health care and we end up having to talk about race instead.
Pearl Clegg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Pearl Clegg's new book is called Deals with the Devil. She spells her last name C-L-E-A-G-E. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Dorothy Farabee and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Writer Cynthia Heimel has offered tongue-in-cheek advice and witty observations about relationships in Sex Tips for Girls and other books. In the introduction to her new book, her now-grown son writes about being brought up by an unconventional mother. We'll meet them both on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.